On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
You have this kind of asymmetrical warfare coming from a guy who's great at a soundbite, lousy at an answer.
So are you looking for your own billionaire?
No, I don't want my own billionaire. I'm going to raise the vast majority of the money.
Brace yourself, America, for what?
King Trump.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
I recognize the division felt by many in our country over the war. And in particular, I feel deeply and sincerely, in a way that no words can properly convey, the grief and suffering of those who lost ones they loved in Iraq.
Former British Prime Minister Tony Blair reacting today to a massive report slamming him for leading Britain into the Iraq War. The report sharply criticizes Britain's political and military leaders, and Blair in particular, for taking the country into a war that was avoidable, according to the report, and ended, quote, a very long way from success. For more on this, Griff Whitty joins us now from London, where he's bureau chief for The Washington Post. Hi there.
Hello, Madeline.
This assessment took 7 years to compile. It is massive, as you write in your piece, five times longer than War and Peace. Tell us about why it took so long to come together.
Well, it took so long because it was an absolutely massive undertaking. The charge that the author of the report, Sir John Chilcot, who is a retired British civil servant, was given was to basically dig into the origins of this war and the prosecution of this war. And he was given unfettered access to British documents. He was told that he could interview absolutely anyone he wanted. And the result was that he and his team spent 7 years really going through every shred of documentation, talking with everyone who was relevant in terms of British decision-making, and coming out with 2.6 million words today that actually were quite revelatory. I think a lot of people thought that everything that there was to be known about the Iraq War was already known. I think a lot of people thought that perhaps this report would just be a whitewash. But in fact, it was quite eye-opening, and I think people are quite surprised by just how damning these conclusions are.
And damning in particular, as I said, of Tony Blair. What are some of the other eye-opening points that people are talking about today?
Well, the report pretty much systematically eviscerates every aspect of this war. It goes into the intelligence that was used as a justification for the war and discusses how faulty that intelligence was. It goes into the discussions back and forth between Prime Minister Blair and President Bush at the time, and the inability of Prime Minister Blair to move Bush toward a more cautious position. There was a long stretch of time where the Brits seemed to be urging caution and urging other options besides war. And ultimately, the Americans just ignored that advice. And despite the fact that the Brits were being ignored, they decided to engage in the war right alongside the Americans anyway. And so one of the main conclusions of this report today was this, that the Iraq War was simply an avoidable war, that there were other options available that were not pursued, and Blair was faulted for not pursuing them.
One of the lines that's come out of this that people are repeating is this memo that he wrote to Bush back in 2002, in July of 2002, so many months before the war in March of 2003, where he says, "I will be with you, whatever." So this is before any kind of UN authorization was even attempted.
And this is a line that's going down very badly here in Britain, as you can imagine. Obviously, the Brits are very proud of the alliance that they have with the U.S., but that line suggests a sort of subservience and a sense of that Britain will go wherever the U.S. leads. And I think that is going to be a line that is going to be hard for Blair to shake in terms of his legacy. There's talk in Britain today among his critics that's a line that should be put on his tombstone, that he basically, in the end, whatever his misgivings were about the war and the lead up to the war, in the end, he basically just went along with the American plan. And what he found out, and another major shortcoming that's discussed in this report today, is that the Brits had no plan really for what would happen after the invasion. They assumed that the Americans did, and the Americans didn't have a plan either. And so no one in the end had a plan for what happened after Saddam was toppled.
Right. And so now what? Now that this report is out, and as we said, it has overturned every rock to find all the details and all the correspondence and all the information possible, what now?
Well, the families of the British service members who died in this conflict, there were dozens of them who were at this presentation today where the report was unveiled, and they had been very anxiously watching this process over this last 7 years, wondering if there would be a true full accounting. And they ended up being quite pleased with the way that this report came out. They felt that it was thorough and that it did justice to the memory of their loved ones. They are saying that this report gives them ammunition to pursue possible legal action against Blair or against others who are responsible for getting Britain involved in the Iraq War. If you talk to legal experts, they'll tell you that legal action is very tricky here. There's not really an appropriate court for this kind of case. The ICC has said that it's not really interested in taking on a case like this. British courts and British prosecutors are not investigating. And so the families certainly are interested in pursuing legal action. Whether they will actually get that opportunity, it's still unclear.
So unlikely that Tony Blair, would face war crimes charges?
The ICC doesn't seem to be the place for that if that's going to happen, and that would be the place if it was going to happen.
Still, his legacy is forever tarnished.
I think so. He was already someone who was deeply, deeply unpopular in Britain, and he did give a very long, robust defense of his record today. He basically spoke for about 2 hours in front of reporters, answered a very large number of questions. And he was, by turns, quite contrite, saying that he apologized for the war's failures, but also quite defiant in saying that the report, as damning as it may be in certain respects, it never proved or suggested that he had deliberately lied, that he had made a case to the British people that was deliberately that he was deliberately deceiving them. And so Blair was very, very insistent on this point, that even though there were mistakes which he acknowledged, even though there was this litany of failures, he said, "I decided to take Britain to war in good faith, and I made a judgment that he seemed to suggest he would still make today." He said the world is a better place without Saddam Hussein in it, and the war had been justified as a result.
Well, some people are saying that this has led to a deep suspicion of politicians in England that has resulted in this latest problem, the Brexit vote, and the very existence of a Great Britain. Is there a connection to be made between the decision to go to war in Iraq and what's happening now in Britain?
Blair was asked that today, and he denied it, but I think it's very clear. I think that there's an unbelievable sense of unease and a sense among the public that they have been betrayed repeatedly by the elite, by their public officials. If you talk to a lot of Brits, they will tell you that they're starting with the Iraq War, going through the financial crisis, going through a litany of various scandals that have been going on here in Britain. They say that they have simply lost faith in the experts and the people who are supposedly in charge. And so when you had the government last month saying, "We have got to stay in the EU because otherwise it would be a cataclysm," and you had experts backing up those assertions, a lot of Brits just ignored those predictions and said, We don't trust the people in charge. We don't trust the experts." And I think there's a very deep cynicism in British politics now that can be traced directly to what happened with the Iraq War and with the case that Tony Blair made for why Britain should invade Iraq.
Griff Whitty is London Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. Thank you.
Thanks, Madeline.
Tony Blair says the world is better off now without Saddam Hussein in it. But that is an open question when it comes to Iraq. 5 years since the U.S. officially pulled out of Iraq, the country is still at war. On Sunday, more than 250 people were killed in Baghdad in an ISIS suicide bombing. The government often struggles to provide basic services like sanitation and electricity. Here to talk about what's going on inside the country and the current U.S. policy there is Borzu Dargahi. He's Middle East correspondent for BuzzFeed News. Hi, Borzu.
Hi.
Well, that bombing was the deadliest in 13 years since the U.S. invasion. What does that say about the security situation in Iraq and ISIS's foothold there?
Well, I mean, I think that these kinds of bombings are very, very difficult to avoid. You know, there's no magic wand that lets you know which cars have explosives in them and which don't. There's, you know, you could set up all the checkpoints in the world and some bombs will get through. But, you know, I think the deeper failures of the government, the fact that the security is so lapsed, that the security forces are fragmented, that there was no fire safety equipment in this arena, in this sort of shopping mall where this bombing took place, that the exit doors were locked. You know, it just speaks to systematic failures of Iraq following the U.S. invasion and the installation of a government that many view as utterly incompetent and utterly paralyzed. The lives of people there have not improved at all. And so what many people say is that a car bombing that should have killed maybe 10 or 15 people ended up killing 250 because of the negligencies of the Iraqi state right now.
Yes, and wounding many more, perhaps 200 or so more. Well, what is the situation when it comes to ISIS in Iraq? How much territory does that group control?
The territory is shrinking to a large extent. In Anbar province, Mosul, the country's second largest city, remains under the control of ISIS. But the territory around that is shrinking, too. But, you know, I think as far as Iraq is concerned, the focus on ISIS is somewhat misguided. I think that even when they defeat ISIS, even when they overthrow, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, they kill Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi and, you know, have this great moment, unless Iraq's fundamental problems, imbalances, its major issues are not resolved, you'll have another jihadi group arising from mm-hmm. the desert. Another, you know, man claiming to, you know, represent the aggrieved of Iraq coming about, whether on the Shia side or the Sunni side, and creating trouble and creating misery for the people.
Well, how engaged is the United States in Iraq now? I read a report that says the troop presence is creeping upward constantly.
Yeah, it's creeping upward. I think that they're still in a mostly advisory capacity, working with the Kurdish troops, the Peshmerga, as well as some of the Iraqi troops as trainers, providing specialized services, providing air support and so on. But, you know, as far as being engaged in the Iraqi political process, which is the sort of incubator of all of Iraq's troubles, I think they've been disengaged for some years now. I think that, you know, even during the Bush administration, they were basically writing off the idea that they could, that anyone could cajole Iraq's various factions into forming a decent government. And I think maybe that's the root of the problem, not so much that, you know, how much they're engaged militarily, but how much anyone is engaged politically to sort of heal Iraq's wounds and create a decent government that can take on ISIS or what comes after.
Yes. Well, I suppose that's the extreme reaction to the idea of regime change and taking an active role that George Bush took.
I think it was just sort of disillusionment with the whole project. You know, I think mm-hmm. there was a lot of on Twitter today, I called it howdy doism, you know, about how we can, you know, this sort of very naive, upbeat kind of assessment about recreating Iraq into a paragon for the Middle East. And once it became clear that that wasn't going to happen, people just started losing interest. People in the State Department, people in the administration. And this was under Bush. And then it accelerated really under Obama, who was elected, if listeners remember, with the promise of getting us out of Iraq.
Yes, and so you saw him announce today that he would leave some troops in Afghanistan. Is this a reaction to that reaction?
No, I'm not sure. You know, I think it more has to do with the sort of situation on the ground in Afghanistan, the inability of the Iraqi government to, of the Afghan government to kind of really take on the Taliban, the signs that ISIS may be rising in parts of South Asia. So I think that it's probably his military advisors, his military, his generals advised him that, look, we can't really start reducing our troop numbers in Afghanistan, given the multiple threats and the potential for ever-expanding threats. I think maybe what happened in Bangladesh just a few days ago with the hostage taking and so on, it sort of underscored the threat that ISIS and other jihadi groups pose to South Asia as well as to the Middle East.
Tony Blair today said it would depend on whom you ask when asked whether or not Iraqis were better off now than they were pre-invasion. He says the Kurds are better off. He says an aide to the Iraqi president said today that Iraq was better off. What do most Iraqis think?
I think most, it's complicated because, you know, Iraq is already fragmented into three or four different security and political configurations. Not even just two or three, like three or four, maybe even, you could even argue that it's, you know, five. But, you know, in the north of Iraq, you know, Erbil, Soleimaniye, Duhok provinces, those areas, the Kurdish areas, are doing great, are doing quite well. You know, there's investment. There is still, you know, sort of growing pains. There's allegations of corruption. There's mismanagement and so on. But, you know, these are sort of normal luxury problems in this part of the world, really.
Yeah.
You know, they have two international airports. Their, you know, economies are at least numerically are doing OK, you know, despite the dependence on oil revenues and so on that are decreasing. There's still some kind of ideal of adhering to some kind of democratic principles and so on. I think that the, you know, far south of Iraq is very quiet, almost placid. You don't hear a lot of security incidents taking place. You know, it's just sort of humming along. There's investment coming in from Iran and the Gulf. You know, and you don't hear a lot of horrific things happening. You know, Baghdad is another story. Anbar province is another story. You know, Mosul and Salahuddin, you know, these sort of Sunni areas that are the sort of battlefields for the fight against ISIS are a different story. So I think those people who live in those areas would, you know, especially in Baghdad, would think, yeah, you know, we had it really good under Saddam Hussein. You know, we could go out at night, we could take our kids to the amusement park and the zoo in the middle of the night, we can get a haircut along this street, and now look at this street. Yeah. It's just totally dead.
Borzu Dargahi, Middle East correspondent for BuzzFeed News. Thanks. And we want to know what you think. Is Iraq an issue that you're thinking about these days? Do you think about it when it comes to the election? Let us know your thoughts at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY or on Facebook at KSRW Press Play. Coming up, remembering the Iranian filmmaker Abbas Kiarostami. He made the personal, political. That's next on Press Play.
Select sessions from KCRW's music program Morning Becomes Eclectic can be experienced in the immersive world of virtual reality. Download KCRW's VR app and get lost in the music. Go to kcrw.com/VR.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The Iranian filmmaker Abbas Kiarostami died on Monday. He was 76 years old. He had been undergoing treatment for cancer in Paris. Kiarostami made more than 40 films and documentaries. Words like intimate and contemplative and poetic have been used to describe his work. His films were not overtly political, though he had his run-ins with conservatives at home. After Taste of Cherry won the Palme d'Or at Cannes in 1997, there were protests at the airport in Tehran because of his association with outsiders. Roya Rostegar is here now to talk about the films of Abbas Kiarostami. She's director of programming at the LA Film Festival. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Now, I understand he was hugely influential in world cinema. People, you know, who knew him really knew him and loved him well. But a lot of Americans don't really know his work. Why?
I think the Academy only 2 weeks ago finally invited him and a whole host of other filmmakers to finally join the Academy. So I think, you know, the Academy sets the sense of who is validated and who is not in America specifically. It's amazing that the Academy had invited him earlier, and it's awesome that he was finally invited. It's too bad it was 2 weeks before his death. But I think that of all the Iranian filmmakers, I think he is the Iranian filmmaker that most Americans know.
Well, tell us why he is so important and influential.
Well, he is one of the kind of the head honcho of this huge wave of filmmaking that happened in Iran, and that's still happening. You know, filmmakers like Jafar Panahi, who is 20 years younger than Abbas Kiarostami, and Mohsen Makhmalbaf, who's another really renowned filmmaker. These filmmakers are all kind of grew up under Abbas Kiarostami. You know, I grew up in the 80s, being Iranian in Atlanta. And so the perception, I was very sensitive to what the perception of Iranians was. And, you know, our media is so skewed in America in terms of presenting what the Middle East is. And I think what's so amazing about Abbas Kiarostami is that he always had these stories about people, just everyday people and their everyday lives and the choices that they would have to make. And his films were so transcendent in terms of their culture. So everybody can kind of relate to his broader themes.
Well, and tell us about Taste of Cherry, the film that won the Palme d'Or. It is about a man planning to kill himself and looking for someone who can bury him.
It's this very, very intimate portrait of a man who wants to kill himself. And he wants to just vanish from the face of this earth. He doesn't want anyone to even find his body. So he's looking for someone who will basically just throw dirt on the hole that he has already dug. And the first person he asks is a soldier. And he's talking to this young soldier. And he's like, you know, you carry a gun. That gun is to kill people. So why won't you just carry this shovel? Basically, it's a setup for the filmmaker to explore these very intimate conversations with people around suicide, around death. And it's not political on the surface of it, you know, because the protagonist isn't saying why he wants to die, but politics is running throughout the film. And this is like all of Kiarostami's films. They all make the personal so, so political.
And he was also a documentary filmmaker. One critic said that his feature films often walk a line, a thin line between fiction and reality. Mm. How did he do that?
So he had a film in 1990 called Close Up. And it starred all of the real people who were involved in a situation that happened in the 80s. And the situation was that this man who loved Mohsen Makhmalbaf, who's another filmmaker, he connects with a family who he finds out also loves that filmmaker. And he basically poses as the filmmaker and kind of leads the family to believe that he will actually put them in his next film. So the
and that really happened.
Yeah, that actually happened in the 80s. And the person, the con artist who was basically saying that he was the filmmaker, ended up going to jail. But what's so cool is that in the film, the con artist plays himself, Abbas Kiarostami plays himself, Mohsen Makhmalbaf plays himself, all the members of the family play themselves. And they just basically recreate this thing that happened 10 years earlier. Mm. And it's not a documentary, but at the same time, it's not fiction.
Yeah, so it's a film about a film about reality, about now I'm confusing myself, but
and this is in the this is in 1990. So I mean, this is kind of, I think, just before docufiction even kind of became a thing that a lot of filmmakers, American filmmakers, were doing. And it wasn't received very well in Iran, but the New York Times called it brilliant. It was on the BFI's list of top 50 best films. And it's a good one to watch just to get a sense of Kiarostami's kind of sense of humor. But also just one of the themes that runs throughout all of Abbas Kiarostami's work is just this concept of choice and how very, very simple choices can lead to say everything about who you are.
Now, even though he was emphatic that his art and his home were intertwined, he made his last two movies outside Iran, one in Tokyo and one in Italy. Why did he do that?
Probably if I were putting myself in his shoes, I would imagine he was in a very complicated position as an Iranian filmmaker, because you have to be very careful how you represent your country and the people, but at the same time, you want to be honest and you want to have a free expression of your creativity and what the story is. But at the same time, your work can so easily be taken up by people who want to find evidence against your country to legitimate wars and all different kinds of things. So I think he was in such a complicated position. And I think one of the benefits of making Certified Copy in 2010, or the film Someone Like Someone in Love, which he shot in Japan in 2012, I think one of the benefits of making two films outside of Iran is that you don't have to keep that always in the back of your mind. It's how are these films going to be kind of used as proof or as evidence of, you know, what the West might be looking for already, which is kind of a sense of Iran as this kind of barbaric place or something. And he was very, very sensitive to that. And he, I think, was one of the filmmakers that really negotiated that the most kind of elegantly or gracefully, because I think he was often called the non-political filmmaker of so many other filmmakers, in comparison, for example, to Jafar Panahi or Mahmoud Rasoulov. Both of those filmmakers were recently imprisoned in Iran. And actually, Abbas Kiarostami really led a movement to release them in 2010. And they have explicitly criticized Iran's democracy and their human rights record. But Abbas Kiarostami, he actually himself always insisted that no film is apolitical. He always insisted that there are politics in all films, because films are anchored in society, and any film that deals with humanity is necessarily political. And that his job as a filmmaker is to show how that politics kind of infuses into everyday life.
Roya Rostegar is the director of programming at the Los Angeles Film Festival. We've been remembering the Iranian filmmaker Abbas Kiarostami. He died on Monday. He was 76 years old. Roya, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And we'd like to hear from you. What's your favorite film by Abbas Kiarostami and why? You can let us know at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, and we may play your message later in the show, or you can tweet us at @KCRW PressPlay. Coming up, every Friday, a small Palestinian village in the West Bank holds protests that are met with overwhelming force by Israeli soldiers.
The Israeli military is afraid that this sort of resistance, if left unchecked, will spread throughout the West Bank. And because of that, from the very beginning, they have made a point of repressing this kind of resistance extremely violently.
Life in the West Bank, next on Press Play.
Subscribe to KCRW's Today's Top Tune Download podcast. To receive a free song of the day, find today's top tune on KCRW's iTunes page.
You're listening to Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. A 17-year-old Palestinian boy broke into a West Bank settlement last week and stabbed to death a 13-year-old Jewish girl while she slept. It is the latest in an ongoing wave of violence around West Bank settlements that's resulted in the deaths of 33 Israelis and more than 200 Palestinians in the last 9 months. More than 500,000 people now live in Israeli settlements in the West Bank. One of those settlements is called Halamish. It sits right next to the small Palestinian village of Nabi Saleh. Since 2011, author and journalist Ben Ehrenreich has been traveling to Nabi Saleh and other Palestinian communities to report on their protests, their confrontations with Israeli troops, and the often harsh realities of their daily lives. The result is a new book. It's called The Way to the Spring, Life and Death in Palestine. And Ben Ehrenreich is here now. Welcome.
It's good to be here, Madeline.
Great to have you. Well, talk about Nabi Saleh. Describe it. What does it look like?
Nabi Saleh is a very small village. It sits on a hilltop about 20 minutes to the northwest of Ramallah. It's about 500-600 people. So very small. It's, you know, like most Palestinian villages, not a particularly rich place. It stands in stark contrast to Halamish, the settlement on the adjacent hilltop. There's not a lot of green there. There's not a lot of water. In Halamish, there's swimming pools and gardens and all sorts of lovely things. You'll see some strange things in Nabi Saleh. A lot of the people in the village have started using tear gas grenades as a kind of lawn ornament, making strings of tear gas grenades because there are so many in the hills. Because for the last nearly 7 years, people there have been staging weekly demonstrations against the Israeli occupation and trying to march to a spring at the base of the village that was confiscated by the settlers in 2008.
So every Friday, they stage a protest.
Every Friday, they stage a protest. And the one thing that can be counted on is that soldiers will greet them with tear gas, often with rubber-coated steel bullets, occasionally with live fire. And really, no matter what they do, usually the tear gas starts before they've made it very far down the road at all.
They actually made it to the spring once.
Once, yeah. They started these demonstrations in December of 2009. And I was lucky, I suppose, in that it was, I think, the second time I was at one of these demonstrations. I don't know if the soldiers miscalculated or weren't paying attention or what, but for some reason, that one day, nobody got in their way. And the villagers actually managed to march to the spring, which they hadn't been able to do for years at that point.
And what happened when they got there?
When they got there, the children were ecstatic. The settlers had sort of turned it into a picnic area with a swing and a table and pools. And the kids were playing on the swing and playing on the pools. And very quickly, of course, the army came. And also very quickly, some settlers came down, also armed. And the settlers insisted to the soldiers that the Palestinians be forced to leave. And it was less than an hour that people were there, that the soldiers were saying, you have 10 minutes to leave or we're going to chase you all away. You know, and everyone knew what that meant. That meant stun grenades, that meant tear gas, that meant it in such close quarters because everyone was right on top of each other, that could easily mean beatings and arrests. And before those 10 minutes were up, the adults decided it was time to go, and they gathered up the children and marched back up towards the village and didn't make it very far. The marchers refused to march on the rocky hillside and tried to march on the road itself. And the Israeli border police tried to force them from the road. And after just a couple of minutes, were throwing stun grenades and shooting tear gas at everyone. And everyone was running. And it was once again a normal demonstration.
What are the settlers afraid of? And what is the military afraid of? Why such a forceful armed response?
You know, I think certainly settlers have reasons to be afraid. I mean, this killing in Kiryat Arba of a 13-year-old girl, which was horrible, I think that kind of thing lodges in the imagination of settlers everywhere. But for the most part, I think, you know, no one in Nabi Saleh was going to sneak into a bedroom and kill someone. This is a movement that's been committed from the start to unarmed resistance. I don't know if it's a question of concrete fears. I think it's more that the Israeli military is afraid that this sort of resistance, if left unchecked, will spread throughout the West Bank. And because of that, from the very beginning, they have made a point of repressing this kind of resistance extremely violently. Two young men in the village have been killed. One was shot in the face with a tear gas canister at close range. Another was shot in the back on a hillside outside the village with a bullet from an M16. Others in the village have been shot with live fire or wounded with rubber bullets, which are not in fact rubber. They have a steel core, including one teenage boy who was put in a coma after being shot in the head with one. So, you know, they've faced an extremely high cost for the kind of resistance that they've been doing, despite the fact that none of them have guns, none of them are shooting anyone, none of them are blowing up anything. They're simply trying to march to bring attention to the confiscation of their land.
In general, not just the springs, but
not just
general.
The spring, yeah.
And they have attracted international attention. They've attracted foreigners who come, foreigners like yourself, but other foreigners as well who come to help them protest.
Yeah, absolutely. I think for them and for the other small handful of villages that have done the same kind of protest, they don't imagine that they're going to take the spring back. Even if they took the spring back, they've made clear their fight wouldn't be over, that they do want to, you know, bring an end to the occupation. And that means they know that they're fighting against this military, which is far, far stronger than they are. And they have no hope of beating it either on its own terms or certainly not by simply marching. But they hope that by doing this, they can enlist support from outside. So from the beginning in Nabi Saleh and the other villages that do this, that's meant welcoming both foreign activists, mainly Europeans, some Americans who go and, you know, in solidarity and go there as witnesses, and also Israelis. There is always a small contingent of left-wing Israeli activists, people who are ashamed of and opposed to their own government's policies and make, I think, a very courageous stand by putting their own bodies on the line beside the Palestinians who live there.
And what about the Palestinian Authority? Are they at all orchestrating these protests? Are they supporting them? How do they view these uprisings?
Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian president, has alluded to these protests in some of his speeches and has sort of taken credit for them. But he has certainly not made any effort to try to get this kind of resistance to spread across the West Bank. Regrettably for this kind of resistance, the PA, I think, is mainly focused on maintaining its own power, and Abbas has certainly been focused on maintaining his own power, which has meant that for years now, and especially in the last 2 years, the PA has often quite violently put down protests against the Israeli occupation with beatings, sometimes with tear gas, sometimes with the same methods that the Israelis use to put down protests. So I think from here, we tend to view the PA and the Israeli government as opponents, you know, as people who are trying to negotiate out a peace between them. And what we don't see from here is what people see very clearly on the ground, which is that they're actually quite bound up with one another, and the interests of the PA authorities are not that different.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Ben Ehrenreich about his new book. It's called The Way to the Spring, Life and Death in Palestine. Now, you state quite clearly at the beginning of your book that this is not a he said, she said type of book, that you were not interested in portraying both sides of this story, if you can say that there are just two sides, which I guess you can never say about any story, but that you didn't really, you weren't interested in the Israeli story, that this was a story about the Palestinians.
I think one of the things that motivated me to write this book was going over there and seeing these extraordinary realities, which I didn't see reflected in the American press at all, that the narrative we get in the U.S. is by and large, I mean, there are a few breaks in this, but by and large, it's an Israeli narrative. Maybe sometime somewhere at the bottom of an article, there'll be a quote from a Palestinian somewhere. But mainly we get the Israeli side of things. When there's violence against Israelis, it makes headlines. But there's daily violence against Palestinians that we never hear about at all. So it was partly to talk about these realities that we don't get to see at all, that I wanted to write this book. And I knew that there would be calls for balance, right? And I don't think there's any other issue that we so demand this so-called balance, which means, you know, adding an Israeli perspective to every Palestinian perspective. But it never works the other way. You know, when we get just the Israeli narrative, there's never the same hue and cry for a Palestinian voice to balance out the Israeli one. So in this rather contradictory way, these calls for balance usually function actually to preserve the existing imbalance.
Are you worried, though, at all that people will read this and say, well, because he didn't include the other side, the Israeli perspective, that we can't trust what he says, that he's sort of in the tank for the Palestinians in this?
Not really, because I think I'm very straightforward about what I'm doing. You know, I think if I pretended to be balanced while, you know, while only giving one side, it would be deceptive and it wouldn't be honest and it would be lousy journalism. And I think that the other side is everywhere. You know, there's half a dozen books that people can read to get that other side of this story. It's in the papers every day. It's on CNN. It's on Fox. And the response to the book so far has shown me that, you know, people are enormously eager and even hungry because they understand that they're getting a very one-sided account through the media and are eager to have a conversation that we haven't been having in this country yet.
You did talk to Israeli soldiers who are involved in this, who have to deal with these protests. And what is going through their minds when they decide to unleash tear gas or rubber-coated bullets or live ammunition on these protesters who have nothing more than rocks?
I think it varies. You know, most of them are quite young. Most of them are kids. They're, you know, 19-year-olds. you know, they're encouraged by their commanders to put down these protests quite aggressively. They're given all of these toys, you know, they're given tear gas, they're given rubber bullets, they're given stun grenades. They have, you know, also have their rifles loaded with, you know, actual ammunition. And they are told that the people they're facing up against are rioters and terrorists and all of these things. So, that, you know, some serious dehumanization has happened before they even get there. So some of them, I think, are fine with it. And some of them are proud of the work that they're doing and go at it quite, you know, it's very clear if you spend time in these demonstrations that some of the soldiers are extremely enthusiastic about their work. Others that I've talked to and read the testimony of are disturbed by it and pause at the fact that they're shooting at unarmed protesters and often shooting at groups of women and children and people who are clearly civilians. And for some of those soldiers, what they're asked to do doesn't match up at all with the kind of heroism that they imagined they'd been involved in as soldiers.
The peace process collapsed, what, 2 years ago?
I guess it was, yeah.
And you've been back recently to Nabi Salla. What do people say about that? Do they want it to be revived? Do they want the quartet to come back and come up with a plan and to have talks again and to figure out a roadmap?
No, it was strange. I was living there for the entirety of the Kerry peace process in 2013 and 14. And here, if you read the papers, you know, there were certainly critical voices, but there was also some optimism because Kerry was staking so much of his own reputation. It was very clear from there, nobody took it seriously. Certainly not the Israelis, and neither did the Palestinians. You know, I think from a Palestinian perspective, everyone there knows the role that the U.S. plays in this conflict, that the U.S. is not a neutral observer, is not an honest, impartial broker, but the U.S. is the prime abettor and enabler and a participant in the conflict. You know, the U.S. gives $3.1 billion of military aid a year to Israel, more than we give to any other country, more than we've given to any country in our history. And we do that no matter what the Israelis do, like, no matter how much the behavior of the Israeli military comes under international censure. The U.S. blocks that censure at the U.N. and it keeps those checks rolling. So Palestinians understand really well that the U.S., you know, if John Kerry comes and says, I want to make peace and I'm on both of your side and you guys can all trust me, they know that with the other hand, he is providing the money that provides the guns, that provides the bullets, that provides the tear gas, that kills their brothers and sisters and their children. So I think it's very hard for anyone there to take, you know, peace process is sponsored by the UN. And of course, the UN is one of the four members of the quartet as well, seriously at all. And to imagine that the US could act in good faith. And I think for Americans too, I think every time there's a new round of negotiations, Americans kind of, you know, we may be cynical about it, but some people get excited. Maybe this is the last chance for the two-state solution. You hear that a lot. You know, it's been the last chance for the two-state solution for quite a time, a long time now. But I think what we would be better off focusing our efforts on is making sure that that sum of money isn't just a blank check for this kind of oppression and continuing injustice, that Americans demand that their government change its policies, because I think that's the only way that we can make sure that these injustices end.
Well, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thanks for having me on, Milo.
That's Ben Ehrenreich. He's a journalist and author. His latest book is called The Way to the Spring, Life and Death in Palestine. Coming up, downtown is becoming choked with gridlock. One solution, get out of your car and get on a bike. Starting tomorrow, you'll be able to do that. We'll talk about that next on Press Play.
Check out KCRW's music blog for song premieres, music news, performances, and KCRW DJ features. Stay up to date on all of KCRW's music happenings at kcrw.com/musicblog.
The This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. If you're downtown tomorrow, you might see a lot of shiny new bicycles zipping around. Metro is launching its bike share program with 1,000 bikes available from 65 hubs all over downtown, from Union Station to Little Tokyo to the Arts District. It's the latest in local bike sharing programs. You may have seen them in West Hollywood, in Long Beach, here in Santa Monica. But Metro is trying to do something different. It's reaching out to low-income communities. Tamika Butler is executive director of the Los Angeles County Bicycle Coalition, which is working with Metro on that effort. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
So tomorrow is a big day. What can we expect to see?
Hopefully a lot of people on bikes. Mm-hmm. It's definitely a big day, and I think it is a celebration. You know, LA has been the car capital of the world, and starting tomorrow, we're going to make a little room for bikes, and we're going to introduce this fun, quick, hopefully, you know, people find it fun. I know I will. And it's a healthy way to just get around downtown on two wheels. And so that's what people should expect to start seeing.
Now, often these bike sharing programs are used by tourists mainly, but I think in this case, Metro is trying to get regular people on the bikes, including low-income riders.
Yes, and I think both are important, and it's been awesome for Metro to recognize that. You know, one of the first places I used bike share was Washington, D.C., and it was awesome because I got to go from every major monument on my bike, you know, check it in, get back on, check it out, go to another place. And we know that L.A. is a little different, that it's not as compact. And so while we would love to have tourists on it and we think tourists will enjoy it, it's also about the everyday riders, the everyday folks just trying to get around downtown LA. And I think we've been really lucky and privileged. The Los Angeles County Bicycle Coalition and Multicultural Communities for Mobility are our partners to work with Metro in the city of LA. And we've gotten a grant for $75,000, which is great, from the Better Bike Share Partnership. And we're really going to work on outreach to low-income communities, communities of color, and try to provide just education and encouragement. Because the last thing we want in any community is, you know, especially in LA, when folks are fearing displacement and getting pushed out in gentrification, we don't want these stations to pop up and for people to think, those aren't for me. Who are those for? And so we really want to be part of that education and outreach to say, no, this is for you. We want you to ride. We want you to participate. This is your city. This is your neighborhood. This is for you.
Well, it's not that cheap. It's $3.50 for a half hour. So is that a big barrier to encouraging low-income people to use it?
Yeah. So, you know, there's three, Metro calls them three simple pass options designed to meet the need of every potential user. And I think, you know, the other part of our project between the Los Angeles County Bicycle Coalition and Multicultural Communities for Mobility, it's not just us going out there and talking to people and saying, this is what it is, this is how much it costs, this is how you check out a bike, this is what you do. It's also us listening. And part of what we want to hear is what people think about this. And, you know, the system is definitely owned by Metro. We are partners who are going to be providing feedback. So ultimately, you know, they have a number of very difficult metrics and things they have to meet, and we want to respect how hard their job is. But as an example, other cities who have looked at equity, like, you know, Philly, New York, we've heard situations where in their outreach they heard from people, you know, 30 minutes for my, you know, initial ride isn't that long. Our city's spread out, and I'm not going to be able to get anywhere in 30 minutes. So I need it to be an hour, and they changed it. And so that, you know, again, will that happen in LA? We don't control the system, so we don't know. But part of our job is being listeners and getting that feedback, price, ease of signing up, how long you can be on the bike. We want to take all of that with that lens towards equity and make sure we're giving Metro the best feedback possible.
Well, do you think Metro would be flexible on the pricing? Could they perhaps make it free for people to use downtown?
I think that's really tough. If I've learned anything in my career, it is not to speak for other agencies. And so, you know, I think we can certainly hope, we can certainly provide feedback, we can certainly give them what they need. But I know the folks at Metro work hard, and I know they have a lot of, you know, directives from the Board of Supervisors and a lot of different things they're trying to answer to. And so I would hate to be in a position where I say, yes, they're going to do it. We're going to give them the information they need to be able to make the arguments, but I'm sure there's other information we won't have.
And what about expanding it outside downtown? What's the plan for that?
So expansion out of downtown is a definite plan, and I think it's something that we're all super excited about. It's supposed to go to other communities in LA County, including Pasadena, North Hollywood, Huntington Park, Venice, Marina del Rey, I think Burbank, I don't know if I said that, East LA, San Gabriel Valley. So, what we've heard is eventually Metro wants a total system that's 4,000 plus bikes. I think one of the beauties of the system being run by Metro, which it doesn't happen in every city that way, it's not always the MTA, but why we're excited about that is because Metro is countywide, and so the possibility that this could go beyond downtown LA is huge, and there's a reason it's just a pilot, because Metro doesn't want to stop there.
Tamika Butler, Executive Director of the Los Angeles County Bicycle Coalition, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And Christian Bordahl is here in for Jolie Myers with the listener feedback.
Hey there, Madeline.
Hi there.
Well, earlier you talked to Bent Ehrenreich about his new book, The Way to the Spring, Life and Death in Palestine. He spent a bunch of time in the West Bank reporting on the life of Palestinians. And in the interview, he called the U.S. the prime enabler of the Israeli military's violence against Palestinians in the West Bank. And Javier Robles agrees. He says we're like the mom of that affluenza kid when it comes to Israel. God forbid anybody in this country dare talk the truth and be objective about Israel, because the name-calling starts right away. But Micah Vetter disagrees. He posted a link to a blog post titled The Deceptions of Bent Ehrenreich. It says a recent article by Ehrenreich in Politico magazine was, quote, literally filled with lies. So, as usually happens when we talk about Israel and Palestinians, there are strong opinions on both sides.
Yes, there are.
We also talked about the Iranian filmmaker Abbas Kiarostami. Mm-hmm. I've never seen any of his films, and I thought he sounded fascinating, so I'm so psyched to see his movies
now. I
know,
neither have I, and now I'm dying to see them. Apparently they're streaming on Hulu right
now. Oh, okay, cool. One of our listeners, Chris Modisette, said that his favorite Kiarostami movie is called Certified Copy. He says that's the best one he's seen. It came out in 2010, stars Juliette Binoche. He says it's beautifully shot and leaves the viewer to draw their own conclusions. So, anyway, I guess
that's the one that was shot in Italy.
Yes, exactly, yeah. So I guess I know what I'm doing this weekend. I'm going to watch some Kiarostami films.
I'm going to be binging on Kiarostami.
Exactly.
Okay, great. And that's it for us here at Press Play. Thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.